Welcome to this meeting of the Economic Society of Australia. My name is Michael Knox. I'm a PARCS President of the Economic Society of Australia Queensland Division. I'm also Chief Economist and Director of Strategy of Morgans Financial Limited. And my task today is to welcome Guy Debelle. Guy Debelle has been Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia since 18 September 2016. Being Deputy Governor also makes him Deputy Chair of the Reserve Bank Board. He is also Chair of the Reserve Bank's Risk Management Committee. In May 2019, he was appointed Chair of the Global Finance Exchange Committee of the Bank for International Settlements. As economists, we are always interested in where an esteemed colleague has done his PhD. Guy studied under two of the best economists alive when he was doing his PhD at MIT. These economists were Stanley Fischer and Rüdiger Dornbusch. Stan Fischer had a late career as Deputy Chair of the Federal Reserve under Janet Yellen. The first time I saw Stan presenting in this role was when he was chairing a panel of Federal Reserve presidents at a presentation in Philadelphia. The body language of the Fed president was obvious. They knew where their boss was in the room, and it was Stan. As the Fed developed its policy on inflation, emphasising the importance of unemployment as a driver of US inflation, I was lucky enough to attend a number of Stan's presentations on the subjects. Rüdiger Dornbusch, I've spoken about Dornbusch at these events before. The late Rüdiger Dornbusch was the greatest international monetary economist living in the second half of the 20th century. When he died in 2002, his eulogy in the Economist magazine remarked, "Dornbusch was always happy to give trenchant advice to governments, whether it was requested or not." He famously gave George Soros the advice which allowed Soros to make $1 billion shorting the pound sterling in 1992. My favourite Dornbusch remark was when the euro was first created, Dornbusch said, "The euro was a bad idea, his time has come." And it's a pity that Dornbusch wasn't around during the Euro area sovereign debt crisis of 2012, so he could take the credit. In March 2002, 4 months before his death, Rudy published a collection of his essays, and the collection was called Keys to Prosperity, Free Markets, Sound Money, and a Bit of Luck. Since the 1980s, Australian policymakers have done much work on giving us free markets. There is more work yet to be done. That we have sound money has much to do with the RBA. The RBA has generated an enormous reputation for credibility and trust amongst global financial institutions. But we still need a little luck, and we may be about to learn if our luck is still with us. After the Deputy Governor speaks, we'll be asking for questions. We'll try to take as many questions as possible after his address. But now, let us listen to a man who was trained by two of the best economists that ever lived. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, Ms. Dr. Guy Debelle.
Thanks very much, Michael, for that very kind introduction, and particularly the very nice words about Stan and Rudy. I'd like to also thank Julian Pearce and the Economic Society for arranging this event. This is actually going ahead on the day it was originally scheduled, but unfortunately I'm not in Brisbane today, but actually back in my office for the first time in 2 months today. So what I'd like to talk about today is the RBA's recent policy actions, and also about its balance sheet. Australia is experiencing an historic event, and it is first and foremost a health event. And thankfully, thus far, the health outcomes in Australia have been better than feared. The health decisions taken by the government and the actions of the public in response to the virus have been the primary shaper of the economic and financial landscape that the Reserve Bank has been operating in. The virus has had a large economic and financial impact. The decline in output in the second quarter in Australia, which we're just finishing today, and around the world has been extraordinary, as significant parts of the economy, both here and right around the world, have been shut down. The decline in output is much larger and much more widespread globally than we saw in 2008. Accompanying this, there has been a very large decline in hours worked. Unemployment has risen sharply, although the extent of the rise in the unemployment rates has varied around the world, depending on the nature of the support provided by governments, as well as some definitional differences. In Australia, the most recent read of unemployment is high at around 7%, but has been materially contained by the JobKeeper package that has helped to maintain the employment relationship between workers and businesses, and this will help considerably in the recovery. Overlaid on top of the health and economic developments was a full-scale financial market disruption in March. Again, this was global in nature, most notably including the dislocation to the US Treasury market, which serves as the critical pricing benchmark for global financial markets. There was an imperative to prevent a financial crisis exacerbating the significant impact of the health and economic shocks. In that environment, policy actions were taken in Australia on multiple fronts, including fiscal, monetary, and prudential. Reflecting these policy actions and the health outcomes, the Australian economy has turned out to be somewhat better in the June quarter than feared. While the outcomes to date have been better than expected, it is very important to remember that the declines in GDP and in hours worked have still been historically large. The objective of the monetary policy response is to support the economy by keeping borrowing costs low and credit available for households and businesses, complementing the necessary and large fiscal policy stimulus. It has also sought to address the disruption in financial markets, particularly in the government bond market, given the central role that the market plays in underpinning the interest rate structure in the Australian financial system. The monetary policy response had a number of elements. A reduction in the cash rate target to 25 basis points. This is the level the Reserve Bank Board has assessed to be the lower bound for the target cash rate in the current circumstance. In saying that, we fully expected the actual cash rate to move below 25 basis points, as it subsequently has, and I'll explain this shortly. Secondly, a target for the yield on three-year Australian government bonds of around 25 basis points. The Reserve Bank commenced a program of buying government bonds to achieve that target and also to address the dysfunction in the market for both Australian government bonds and the bonds of the state governments, or semis. Thirdly, the Reserve Bank's daily market operations were expanded in size and in maturity in response to the large increase in demand for liquidity from the banking system. Fourthly, a term funding facility for the banking system to provide three-year funding at a rate of 25 basis points. And for the non-bank lenders, this was complemented by the AOFM's program of support. And finally, we set the rate paid on exchange settlement balances, or ES balances, and that's a phrase to keep in mind, so I'm going to use that a few times, but they're the balances that the banks hold at the RBA. So we set the rate paid on those balances at the RBA at 10 basis points. So in the rest of this talk, I'll explain these policies in more detail and provide an assessment of their effectiveness so far. These policies have also had a material impact on the size of the and composition of the Reserve Bank's balance sheet, which I will also describe. And so what I'm showing here is the weekly evolution of the RBA balance sheet since the beginning of March. And what I'm going to do is go through most of those different coloured bars and explain why and how they've moved. And I will also explain one of the other main influences on the size of the RBA's balance sheet, besides our policy actions, which results from the fact that the RBA is the banker for the Australian government. But let me start by talking about the lowering of the cash rate. So the reduction in the cash rate target to 25 basis points is more in the realm of standard monetary policy. And so what I'm showing here is the cash rate target, which is the dark blue line, which is now at 25 basis points, the actual cash rate traded in the cash market, which is the red line, and then the bottom of the cash, of the corridor for the cash rate, which is the dotted line, and then finally the market's expectations of where they think the actual cash rate will go, which is the blue line. So the reduction in the cash rate affected the interest rate structure of the economy in a similar way to other earlier reductions in the cash rate target. However, while the actual cash rate target has remained at 25 basis points, while the cash rate target has remained at 25 basis points, the actual cash rate, the red line, traded in the market has declined to be around 13 or 14 basis points currently. This decline in the cash rate was expected and is consistent with the aim of reducing funding costs in the Australian economy. It reflects the large amount of ES balances, exchange settlement balances, in the system. And I will come to the reasons why ES balances are high shortly. But basically, with high ES balances in the cash market, the supply of these balances is large relative to demand. And so, as in any market, with supply greater than demand, the price to clear that market, in this case, the cash rate, has declined. So you can see on the graph that the cash rate is higher than the rate of return we're paying on ES balances of 10 basis points. Banks are incentivized to lend their excess ES balances that they hold with us, but the transaction costs and greater credit risk involved mean that they are generally willing to do so only if they can earn a return a few basis points more than they get from leaving them overnight with us at 10 basis points. The transaction volumes in the cash market have declined, reflecting the fact that on any given day, most banks have enough ES balances to meet their liquidity needs, and so they don't need to borrow. But depending on the distribution of payment flows throughout the day, even with large ES balances, some banks may still need to borrow at the end of the trading day to ensure their balance with us remains positive. It is worth remembering that the banking system as a whole has to hold the level of ES balances supplied by the Reserve Bank. So someone has to end up holding the ES balances at the end of the day. So while any bank may try to lend that away, at the end of the day, someone has to hold them. The higher level of ES balances in the system has not only meant that the cash rate trades closer to the rate that we pay on them, but it also anchors other money market rates, such as short-term repurchase agreements or repos, foreign exchange swaps, and bank bills. So with these rates in money markets anchored, the full spectrum of borrowing rates for households, businesses, and governments is also at historically low levels, and I'll come back to this later. It is worth noting that once the supply of these balances is sufficiently high to lower these rates towards that deposit rate of 10 basis points, the exact amount of ES balance has little effect on where the cash rate and other money market rates trade. That is, additional ES balances do not tend to lower market rates any further. So the curve is pretty flat at these levels of ES balances. Nor does a reduction increase market rates as long as they remain sufficiently high. Since late March, ES balances have moved in a very wide range between 40 billion and 90 billion without having a noticeable effect on money market rates. As you can see from the thin blue line here, the market expectation is that the cash rate will remain around its current level of 13 or 14 basis points for at least the next year. And this is consistent with the Reserve Bank Board's guidance that the cash rate target will not be raised until progress is made towards full employment and that it is confident that inflation will be sustainably within the 2 to 3% target band. Given the outlook for inflation and the labour market, this is likely to be some years away. So let me now turn to talk about the three-year yield target. The board has announced a target for the three-year Australian government bond yield of around 25 basis points. As I just said, given the outlook for unemployment and inflation, the board expects that the cash rate will remain at its current low level for some years, and the target for the three-year bond rate reinforces the forward guidance on the cash rate. At the same time, the Reserve Bank also stands ready to purchase government bonds to address market dysfunction. And in March, bond markets around the world were very dysfunctional. This included the market for US Treasuries, which sits at the core of the global financial system. US Treasuries are a critical benchmark for pricing in global financial markets. Similar dynamics that contributed to the dysfunction in the US Treasury market occurred here in the Australian government bond market, as well as in other advanced economy bond markets. And some of these dynamics included a desperate scramble for cash as portfolio managers and other investors sought to increase the amount of cash in their portfolios, in part to meet redemption requests and margin calls, but in part reflecting asset reallocation by their investors. The portfolio managers achieved this reallocation by selling the most liquid part of their portfolios, which was often fixed income and particularly government bonds. Secondly, there was portfolio rebalancing. So as equity prices decline, but bond yields, the value of bonds goes up, asset managers rebalance their portfolios by selling bonds and buying equities. Thirdly, there was some unwinding of some leverage trades where people had taken positions in the bond market exploiting small price discrepancies, and not dissimilar to LTCM back in 98. And as these discrepancies are generally very small, leverage is required to make the trades worthwhile. And as interest rate volatility increased, these traders were required to unwind these positions, generating further selling pressure and even higher interest rate volatility. And fourthly, a number of emerging economy central banks intervened in their FX markets to support their exchange rates as they depreciated. And this involved selling US treasuries mostly, but also other bonds in their foreign reserves portfolios, including Australian government bonds. And you can see the effect of these sales in the by foreigners in Australia's balance of payment statistics for the March quarter. And finally, there were constraints on dealer balance sheets. So these are the people who act as the intermediaries between investors and the government issuing the bonds, so the bond dealers. So investors sell their bonds to the dealers who act as the main intermediaries in the bond market. In the face of the large selling pressure, dealers were constrained in their ability to take on these flows by the changed regulatory environment over the past decade, as well as their own risk limits. And while this shouldn't have been surprising to people, it nevertheless increased the degree of price volatility and dysfunction in the market. The dysfunction was evident in the heightened interest rate volatility in the bond market, reflecting the reduced liquidity even in the US Treasury market, which is generally regarded as being amongst the most liquid of all markets. And it was also evident in this market in a widening in bid-ask spreads, which I'm showing here. So a bid-ask spread is the difference between the price at which a dealer is willing to buy and sell a bond. And you see most of the time it's around 1 or 2 basis points at most, but you can see it spiked markedly higher through March and into April. So as was the case with many other central banks, the Reserve Bank bought government bonds in the secondary market to try to alleviate the dysfunction in the market. And these purchases helped to restore the functionality to this market, which is an important pricing benchmark in the financial system. Clearly, an effectively functioning bond market is also necessary to allow governments to issue bonds to finance the fiscal stimulus. The Reserve Bank bought bonds at or near the 3-year horizon to achieve the 3-year yield target, but we also bought bonds along the yield curve to help achieve the target and also address the market dysfunction. So the next graph shows the bonds that we've purchased by maturity. To date, we've purchased just over 40 billion of Australian government bonds, Commonwealth government bonds, and a sizable share of those purchases were between 3 and 10 years. And these purchases significantly reduced the constraints on dealer balance sheets, which facilitated a faster return to a more functional bond market. We didn't buy bonds beyond the 10-year maturity nor index bonds because these bonds play a less important role as a pricing benchmark and very few other financial instruments price off them. Our assessment also was that if we restored functionality in the core part of the bond market, it would probably spread to those other parts of the curve, and indeed that's what's turned out to be the case. So the RBA's purchases in the second half of March and into April helped to improve the functionality in the broader bond market and achieve the board's target for the 3-year bond yield of around 25 basis points. So that what I'm showing here is the 3-year bond yield, and you can see the introduction of the target, and then basically over the last while it's been trading right around 25 basis points. The improved functionality of the market has occurred alongside very sizable issuance by the government, which has been met with very strong demand. The 3-year bond yield has been consistent with the board's target, and the government bond market has been functioning effectively for a number of weeks now. If the 3-year bond yield target is credible to the market, then the bank does not need to purchase many bonds at all to actually achieve the target. And indeed, that's been the case over the past month or so, and we haven't needed to buy any bonds since early May. Nevertheless, the RBA stands ready to scale up its purchases if necessary to achieve these objectives. The bank has also purchased state government bonds to improve the functioning in that market. And the state governments also require a functioning bond market to be able to finance their fiscal stimulus. Again, these purchases were conducted in the secondary market. And to date, these purchases have totaled around 11 billion and the amount of bonds bought from each state has been broadly proportional to their size. Conditions in the semis market have also returned to their pre-crisis state, and the state borrowing authorities have also been able to issue sizable amounts of bonds in a short period of time. So with the cash rate around 13 or 14 basis points and the target for the three-year Australian government bond yield around 25 basis points, you would expect yields on bonds with maturities between the cash rate and 3 years to be no more than around 25 basis points. But at times we've seen those bond yields rise a bit higher, partly reflecting the fact that they tend to be in less demand. And so again, the Reserve Bank is prepared to buy those bonds should their yields rise too high for a sustained period. When the RBA is buying government bonds, we are buying them in the secondary market. That is, they are bonds that have been issued to investors sometime earlier by the AOFM, which is the government's borrowing authority. The RBA buys these bonds via an auction mechanism with the dealer panel banks as counterparties, although the bond dealers in turn have been sold the bonds from other investors, the ones who originally bought them. The RBA is not participating in any of the AOFM's tenders for new bonds and does not purchase bonds directly from the state government borrowing authorities either. When we buy government bonds, the amount of ES balances in the system increases as we credit the accounts of the banks that we buy them from. And so these purchases are not sterilised. If you go back and remember your Dornbush and Fisher macroeconomics, when the central bank buys and sells government bonds, it can choose to sterilise these bonds, i.e. offset their impact on the financial system or not. We aren't sterilising these purchases. So the $50 billion of bond purchases have increased exchange settlement balances and provided a substantial boost to the liquidity in the system. Other factors also affect the level of ES balances, as I discussed below, which have offset some of this impact. When these bonds that we hold mature, the government repays the funds to us in exactly the same way it does every other holder of a bond. And in terms of the RBA's balance sheet, there is a decrease on the asset side of our balance sheet by the amount of the maturing bond that we hold. And on the liability side of our balance sheet, there is a matching decrease in the government's deposit account with us as the government uses the funds it has in those deposits to repay us. While the bond purchases by the Reserve Bank increase liquidity in the system, I do not see this posing any risk of generating excessively high inflation in the foreseeable future. Indeed, the opposite seems to be the more likely challenge in the current economic climate. That is, that inflation will remain below the RBA's target. Nor do I see any issue at all with the capacity of the government to repay the bonds it has issued. Firstly, even with the increased issuance to fund the fiscal stimulus, the stock of government debt relative to the size of the Australian economy remains low. Secondly, the government is borrowing at yields that are very low historically. Importantly, the yields on government debt are considerably below the long-run growth rate of the Australian economy. That is, R is less than G. The interest rate is less than the growth rate. And while ever this remains the case, as Olivier Blanchard has recently highlighted, and this goes back a long way in economics, there are no concerns at all about fiscal sustainability from increased debt issuance. This is because growth in the economy will work to lower government debt as a share of the size of the economy. Let me now talk a bit about supply and liquidity in our market operations. As the dysfunction in markets intensified in March, the RBA responded to the increased demand for liquidity by significantly increasing the supply of liquidity in our daily market operations. This alleviated funding pressure in the banking system and met the increase in precautionary demand for liquidity. And we did similar stuff in the financial crisis in 07-08. Through March and April, the RBA increased the size of its daily operations and provided regular 3 and 6 month terms to meet this demand for liquidity. And these operations also boosted ES balances. In recent weeks, there has been much less demand for funding at the Reserve Bank's market operations. This is because financial conditions have stabilised and because the liquidity position of the banking system is now much greater with ES balances at such a high level. Indeed, some of those earlier liquidity injections that we did in March are now maturing. And as they mature, we expect them to be replaced, but probably not one for one, again reflecting the ample liquidity in the system, as well as the availability of the term funding facility, which I'll come to in a second. Given this, the RBA will scale back the frequency of its longer-term operations, but for the term it offers, we are prepared to satisfy whatever amount of funding is demanded in our daily operations to keep money market rates low. If liquidity conditions were to tighten up again, we'd expect to see more demand in our daily operations, which we would be prepared to accommodate. The ample amount of liquidity in the system is sufficient to ensure that money market rates remain at low levels. The cash rate, as I said earlier, remains low at around 13, 14 basis points. Market expectation suggests it's going to stay that way for at least a year. And reflecting the large amount of system liquidity as well as strong growth in the banking system, the rate at which banks can borrow in the money market, the bank will swap rate, or BBSW, is also at very low levels. And the low level of these money market interest rates are materially contributing to the lower borrowing costs for households and businesses. Let me now turn to the TFF. The TFF provides three-year funding for the banking system at a fixed interest rate of 25 basis points. One can think of this as equivalent to the repo transactions in our daily operations, but for a longer term than normal. So under this facility, banks can borrow an amount up to 3% of the size of their loan book until the end of September. They are able to draw on additional amounts beyond that if they increase their lending to businesses, and particularly small and medium-sized businesses. The cost of funding available to the banking system under the TFF at 25 basis points is significantly lower than the cost of three-year funding for them in the market. And it's even larger discount for the smaller and regional banks. Hence, the TFF is contributing to a lower cost of funding for the banking system and thereby to lower household and business borrowing costs. In aggregate, the size of the TFF allocation is sufficient to replace all of banks' maturing bond funding over the next 6 months. We have seen the announcement of the TFF contributed lower borrowing costs, even though the total drawings by banks under the TFF have been modest to date relative to the size of the available funding. So far, over 60 institutions have drawn on the TFF, with smaller institutions drawing a higher share of the funding available to them. And we expect increased drawings in the coming months as banks use the TFF funds to replace their maturing debt funding. The strong growth that we've seen in deposits in the banking system has also reduced the immediate need for them to access the TFF. Some of that deposit growth was likely, so what I'm showing here is just the deposits in the Australian banking system as a whole, and you can see it kick up in the last couple of months. Some of that deposit growth was likely temporary as businesses drew on precautionary lines of credit and placed the funds drawn on deposit at the bank, and we've seen some of this reverse since April. But some of that increase in deposits is likely to be more long-lasting. So hence, as a result of the Reserve Bank's policy actions, there has been a substantial increase in system liquidity, which is evident on our balance sheet. And that's coming through a number of channels, our daily market operations, the TFF, and our purchases of Australian government bonds. And these policy actions are working as expected. The target for the cash rate, the level of the actual cash rate, the three-year government bond yield target, mean that these important pricing benchmarks anchor a low risk-free yield curve in the Australian financial system. Together with the liquidity provided through market operations, this has lowered the cost of funding for the banking system. And in turn, this has been transmitted through to lower borrowing costs for households and businesses, which you can see in this graph. So what I'm showing here is the borrowing rates for businesses and households, and you can see the marked drop in those rates over recent months. Let me talk very briefly about one other major factor that has a major influence on the bank's balance sheets, namely government transactions. As Bank for the Australian Government, the government's transactions in the form of spending, taxing and debt raising all settle across our balance sheets. And those actions inject and remove funds from the system as a whole and move our balance sheet around. In normal times, we aim to sterilise the impact of such transactions on liquidity to ensure the cash rate remains the target set by the board. But with system liquidity at a high level, this is no longer necessary. As a result, ES balances will fluctuate with these government flows, and they can be quite large and move ES balances significantly. And so what I'm showing here, or in this graph, which is coming up in a second, it's the size of government deposits on with us at the Reserve Bank. And one thing you can see there is in around about mid-May is the government issued a $19 billion bond, which was the largest bond ever issued in Australian history. And you can see that resulted in a very large rise in government deposits. So these government transactions, taxing, spending and debt issuance really move the RBA's balance sheet around a lot, in addition to the Reserve Bank's policy actions. So let me try and pull that all together. So to conclude, the Australian economy has been significantly affected by the virus and the associated health policy actions. This has warranted a comprehensive policy response from both fiscal and monetary policy. The monetary policy response has been directed at supporting households and businesses by keeping funding costs low and ensuring credit is available. The monetary policy actions have worked as expected by lowering the key interest rate benchmarks in the economy to historically low levels, which is being transmitted through to historically low borrowing costs for households and businesses, as well as governments. The RBA's policy response has also resulted in large changes in its balance sheet, and I've tried to provide a guide to those changes. But it's worth noting that our balance sheet, as I said, can be affected by a number of other factors in addition to our bank's policy to the bank's policy actions. And as such, the balance sheet size is not the best way to assess the stance of what we're doing. Recent data indicate that the outcomes in the Australian economy have been a bit better than earlier feared. But we should not lose sight of the fact that the decline in the economy and the impact on households and businesses is historically large. Notwithstanding the better than feared outcomes, the fiscal and monetary support that has been provided was and remains warranted. There is considerable uncertainty over the path from here, and this uncertainty includes the behavioural responses as health restrictions have been eased. There is also considerable uncertainty about the future, which will affect the decisions of both businesses and households. It has taken a long time to recover from large declines in the economy in the past. So what the cause of the decline this time is much different from those in the past, and many of the imbalances that exacerbated declines in previous downturns aren't present this time, but it is still quite likely that this decline will have a long-lived impact that will require considerable policy support for quite some time to come. While much of that support is likely to be on the fiscal side, the Reserve Bank will maintain the current policies to keep borrowing costs low and credit available, and stands ready to do more as the circumstances warrant. So let me finish there. Thanks.
Well, Guy, you've kind of answered the first question I was going to ask, which was about how the reputation of the RBA or forward guidance contributed to interacts with quantitative easing. So quantitative easing is sometimes called money printing. The announcement of quantitative easing in both the US and Australia has been followed by a dramatic rise in the money supply in both countries. Is this a result of quantitative easing, or are people just holding money because they're so scared?
It's a result of both. Well, I'm not sure whether it's necessarily because they're scared, but it's both. It is partly a consequence of our actions, as I said earlier in my speech. When we buy government bonds, that puts more deposits in the banking system, so that adds to the money supply. But also, as I said earlier, we've seen an increase in deposit holdings by both households and businesses. And you can see that quite easily. In the business case, on the corporate side, some part of what happened was businesses drew down on their lines of credit and then turned around and stuck the money on deposit at the bank after having drawn that down. And what we've seen over May and June is some of those deposits being unwound as they've repaid those lines of credit. But nevertheless, it's still higher than it was. And on the household sector side, we've seen increase in deposits as well. And then finally, in your neck of the woods, in the asset management space, we've seen a lot of super funds, asset managers and whatever hold more money on deposits because they need to meet calls on their liquidity as well. So all of those things have contributed to that growth in deposits in the system.
So my second question now goes back to that time before the pandemic. And before the pandemic, the RBA cash rate was 75 basis points. But even at that very low rate, the RBA seemed to be unable to get unemployment down to full employment of 4.5% or inflation up to its target of 2 to 3%. Where do you think the nominal neutral rate of the Australian cash rate should be? Is it between 2 and 3% or is it below 2%?
I don't know at the moment. I think what we do know is it's come down over recent years, both because of, sort of globally this is, because of a decline in population growth and a slow rate of sort of technological progress. I'm not quite sure where we are. Those two things are still there, but there's some other and the aging of the population. Possibly even more importantly. So those factors are still around, contributing to low mutual rates globally. What we have also seen is a very large increase in risk aversion, at least for a time, which is also going to affect the mutual rate. So it's a little hard to tell where it is at the moment. I'd be very surprised to think that it's gone up. Whether it's come down much further from its already pretty low levels, I'm not so sure.
To get my microphone unmuted. So I've been trawling through the questions online, which are coming through thick and fast. You'll be pleased to know, Guy. There's a number of questions about negative interest rates and the practicalities of those. So we have a question from David Tripe about the RBA's views on the practicalities of negative interest rates if economic conditions should not improve quickly. And can I roll that in with another question from Isaac Gross? He says, alternatively, has the RBA considered setting the term funding facility rate below zero as the European Central Bank has? And would that be an alternative to encourage lending without threatening bank profitability in the same way that a negative cash rate might?
Yeah, they're both good questions. I mean, Phil's talked about negative interest rates over the last couple of months, and we don't see in the current circumstances that there is a need for them. If I look at the experience offshore of some of the countries which have adopted negative interest rates, including the ECB, it's not entirely clear how effective they've been. In terms of the TFF rate, I mean, what we don't see, I think at the moment there's not much issue with the supply of funding. And it's as much an issue on the demand for funding. So when businesses aren't, the low level of growth in business lending is not because the cost of finance is too high. It's because there's a huge amount of uncertainty about their future prospects and about the future outlook for the economy. That's the number one factor, which is restraining stuff. So I don't, in all our liaison, no one brings up the cost of borrowing, which is at all-time lows here, as a constraint on their willingness, on their appetite to borrow. And the banking system at the moment is flush with funds, and so would happily lend them should they find someone who's willing to borrow them. So, it seems to me it's the lack of appetite for borrowing at the moment, which is a function of the outlook for the economy, which is really the main issue rather than the actual cost of funds.
So if we're concerned about the economic outlook, you mentioned fiscal policy, and we don't have particular concerns about fiscal sustainability when R is less than G. Mm. Does that imply the federal government should be doing sort of everything it can in terms of fiscal stimulus to get the economy moving and unemployment down? And what does good stimulus look like?
The government is providing plenty of stimulus at the moment. There'll be a very large expansion in fiscal policy. They're clearly considering at the moment, as has been made clear by the Prime Minister and the Treasurer over recent days, so they're thinking about what the shape of that stimulus looks like going forward. And we'll find out more about that in about 3 weeks' time or so, when later in July. They have been providing a sizable amount of fiscal stimulus, and they've made it clear that fiscal stimulus will continue in some form beyond here, because it's needed to support the economy. And I suppose we'll just find out more about that in a few weeks' time.
Do you have any particular concerns about the fiscal cliff when all those supports come off at the end of September?
I mean, if they do all, if everything ceases at the end of September, then yes, that would be a problem. The government, again, the Treasurer and the Prime Minister made it very clear in recent days that they are well aware of that. It's pretty obvious. And they are considering what they're going to do to address that. And as I said, we'll find out more in a few weeks' time.
Okay, great. So we've had questions about inflation expectations as well. And as I think you said, the risk is probably on the downside. A question from Matt Cowgill: given that inflation expectations are below the bottom of the bank's target band, does that remain a concern for the bank? And if so, what do you think can be done to bring expectations back up to target?
I'm not sure whether they're necessarily below. I mean, wage outcomes are at the lower end. I'm not, you know, various measures of inflation. If you're trying to get them off the bond market, that's not a particularly good read at the moment. There hasn't been for the last few months because of the dysfunction I talked about earlier. But yeah, inflation expectations have been on the low side. That's true. I mean, the main thing we're trying to do is get stronger growth in the economy. I mean, that's the primary objective, to try and get people back in jobs, to try and put some upward pressure on wages and prices. But the primary issue at the moment is we have, you know, the economy is operating a very, very long way below capacity. Until we can try and address that, then it's not clear that we've got a bit, you know, inflation, it's not clear that's going to be the main channel, sorry, to try and address low inflation expectations, to try and get a much stronger economy going.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder to the media, if you do want to ask questions, if you can just identify yourself. I can't see any specific media ones coming in at the moment. I had one flagged from Lynn Lenton about asset prices. Mm-hmm. One of the keys to recovery out of this crisis and in the longer term will be increasing productivity and wage growth, but excruciatingly high asset prices have been acting as a massive drag on productivity since the GFC. So his question is, can't we just let asset values deflate?
Asset prices are what they are. I mean, our main objective is to get people in jobs and get the economy operating at full capacity. Asset prices are somewhat of an outcome of that. I mean, the Australian share market at the moment is basically, I think, basically back to where it was in 07. So I'm sure our stock market is, it hasn't risen anywhere near as much as the US has. So, I mean, but asset prices are an outcome. What we're trying to do is to get people employed and try and get inflation back up between, consumer price inflation back up between 2 and 3%.
Speaking of getting inflation back up, a question from Gigi Foster from our New South Wales committee. Does the RBA see stagflation as a risk in the next year?
What quarter are we up to now? The June quarter, but there was a very large drop in petrol prices, and there's a very large drop in the way the ABS is going to measure childcare prices, because the government, you know, childcare was free. So those two things pretty much by themselves are going to give you potentially a negative outcome for the CPI in the June quarter, depending on what else was going on. And the economy went backwards. So, you know, if what you mean by that is, falling prices and the economy's going backwards, well, we probably had that in June. Going forward from here, we do hope, do expect the economy is going to pick up some, and some of those things are going to unwind. Petrol prices have come up a bit at some point, potentially, you have to pay for childcare again. So there's going to be upward pressure on inflation. But stagflation is high inflation and low growth. I don't see that as being likely at the moment. As I said earlier, the more likely outcome is low inflation and a subdued economy. I really don't see much risk of high inflation coming from any source at the moment.
Thanks. A question from Kexen Oyong. Are there rules of thumb for the impact of rate cuts on growth? In other words, do you have some way to estimate the impact of unconventional monetary policy on GDP?
Part of it, I mean, so what we do have a reasonable handle on is the effect of lower borrowing rates on growth. And so we can partly calibrate the impact of of the recent policy actions we've taken in terms of their impact on borrowing rates, which I went through earlier in the speech. And, a starting point to assess the impact of them is basically what we've seen in the past in terms of how the economy's responded to lower borrowing rates. One caveat around that potentially is what I talked about earlier, which is there may not be a particularly large appetite to borrow from the corporate sector or the household sector at the moment, which may diminish some of those impacts. But if we go through the various transmission channels of monetary policy, so you think about lower borrowing rates, lower deposit rates, the impact on the exchange rate, then you can think about how they may or may not be working in the current circumstance and use that to estimate the impact of what's going on at the moment.
Fantastic. So we have a question on full employment.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we, I'm sorry, from Phil Kalaragas, why are we pegging the full employment rate at 4.5%? Does the recent experience in the US suggest that it might be lower? And where do you think it actually sits?
I don't know. With any like, Phil was asked this question a while back, and I mean, the point I suppose we'd make is that when we were getting closer to 4.5%, it was conceivable that actually it could have been lower. We don't have a strong view on that. It's more a question of see what happens when we get there. So there's no, there's no hard and fast rule as to what full employment is. It's, a function of the overall state of the economy. We've had a major disruption to the economy right now, which may have an impact impact on that as well. And we'll just have to see how that unfolds, really.
Thank you. A question from Saul Eslake that goes to transparency of operations. He says, unless I'm looking in the wrong place, the RBA, unlike most other central banks, doesn't publish the amount of government bonds it is holding in its weekly and monthly balance sheet publications.
You are looking in the wrong place.
Okay. Well, that's
We have done so forever and a day, actually. So you can look at the links in my speech. So if you haven't found them before now, just read the speech online and it will direct you to the parts of the website where we do publish this information.
Excellent. Well, that's a nice, easy one to be able to clear up. So thank you for that.
Yep.
So a question from Jeff Orton around liquidity and super funds. Would the Australian financial system benefit from increased resilience to severe unanticipated shocks, particularly liquidity resilience, specifically by allowing access to public liquidity from the RBA by large super funds?
I'm not sure. I suppose what I would say, which I tried to allude to in the, the idea that, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a change in the regulatory landscape, which has made the willingness and capacity of the banks to provide liquidity in markets, it's reduced that. That's been well known and, shouldn't have been surprised to anyone in particular when that started, as things sort of turned volatile in March. However, it appears it was a surprise to people. I do think the system actually turned out to be fairly resilient to all of that in the end. There were some concerns along the way, but that environment has changed in terms of the provision of liquidity by the banking system, by the global banking system, and asset managers in particular have continually said that they've taken account of that and that they're that their operations were resilient to such a shock. So, to some extent they were forewarned and to, varying degrees people took account of that. It's not obvious to me that, it's not a question that I think we're necessarily considering as to whether we need to be the liquidity provider of last resort to every financial market. I said, there were some stresses there for a while, but in the end, stuff, markets settled down and by and large, people got through that okay.
A related question around financial system risks from Nav Maranatna from Morgan's Financial. He's worried about solvency issues as the lockdowns persist and the fact that we're seeing sort of increasing number of corporates filing for bankruptcy. Are you concerned about those solvency issues and how it will flow through to the banking system?
What we have done together with APRA and the banking system is run stress tests on the banking system to assess their resiliency to the economy and to various scenarios for the economy. I mean, one point I would highlight is the banking system came into this with a much higher level of, this globally, but particularly locally, came into this episode with a much higher level of capital than they did in 07, 08. And so a much more resilient to the a downturn in the economy now than they were then. So they have a reasonable capacity to absorb stuff. Just interestingly, right at the moment, notwithstanding a few high-profile bankruptcies, the feedback we get from liquidators, they're actually not seeing a lot of bankruptcies right now. They're expecting them to come, but as of today, they're not quite there. And in fact, so much so that they're concerned that at the moment, you know, they don't have enough work, but they can see a very large chunk of work coming down the pipe. So we're not quite there yet. But in, you know, given the size of the downturn in the economy and the large hit to corporate income across a number of sectors, it, you know, it's going to come. And the question, you know, and it will be the question of how resilient the corporate sector is going to be. One other point which is worth making is the corporate sector in Australia came into this episode with a lot less leverage than corporate sectors in some other parts of the world, including the US. So leverage in the Australian corporate sector was not particularly high. In fact, it was at the lower end of recent experience coming into this episode. But nevertheless, it's something we and APRA are very mindful of is the potential impact of an increasing level of insolvencies in the period ahead.
I think particularly as those government supports come off and the changes to the insolvency laws come off, you know, may be greater risk there. I have a question from one of our high school students online, Catherine Wang. She asked whether you think the inflation target between 2 and 3% is still a suitable objective for monetary policy, considering that we've been outside the band for 4 years now. She asked, should we be adjusting the inflation target or looking for other measures to quantify the success of monetary policy?
Ironically, just before the last reading we had on the CPI in for the March quarter, inflation was actually just above 2%. But, you know, that's got a bit lost in the wash. So anyway,
you know, probably on average, it's been below for an extended period.
Yeah, no, I know that, but I said it's slightly carried. Things were looking okay on that front, and then this came along, and now it's not. But I still think it remains appropriate as a medium-term objective for policy, you know, getting the economy back towards full employment and inflation back between 2 and 3%. And, you know, I still think that is a worthwhile, you know, medium-term objective. I acknowledge that, you know, inflation's been a little bit below that for a few years on average, but I still think it serves as a reasonable guidepost for monetary policy. But a good question, nevertheless.
Indeed. They're very fantastic to have so many high school students online. And great question from Catherine. A question about hysteresis. You know, do you think that's a real phenomenon? And do you think the fall in output that we've seen in recent months is going to have flow-on effects for potential output going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about that at the end of my speech. I mean, I think, you know, there's a reasonable amount of evidence, strong evidence for the presence of hysteresis. I mentioned Olivier Blanchard during my speech. So the work that Olivier and Larry Summers did quite a few years ago now on hysteresis, I think demonstrates that it's very, very real phenomenon, the sort of scarring effects of unemployment. So, yeah, absolutely. I think it's out there. It's a real phenomenon and something which is going to have an impact on the evolution of the economy going forward. As you know, that's basically how I finished with saying, you know, this has been a major event in the economy. It is going to have long-lasting effects. And, you know, hysteresis in terms of labour market outcomes is potentially going to is almost certainly going to be present. I would note though that to some extent that is part of partly informs the policy decision around JobKeeper is if you maintain the attachment between a business and workers, then that potentially reduces some of that impact. It's still going to be there if there is no business. But if it does come back, then that hopefully reduces the potential size of that. But, yeah, it's definitely going to be an issue.
Excellent. And we will have one final question before we wrap up. It's Jonathan Shapiro from the AFR. He's asking if the RBA is concerned about the relative aggression of central banks in terms of considering policies such as negative interest rates and potential direct financing that they may create unhelpful upward pressure on the currency?
Yes, thanks, Jonathan. I mean, we have to be mindful of the actions that other central banks take, because they have an influence on global financial conditions, and they in turn have an influence on financial prices here, including through the exchange rate. And so, that's something we certainly have to take account of, as has always been the case. But the only other thing I'd note is, part of it, the difference in central bank actions is also a function of the difference in economic outcomes. As I said earlier, we've had a really large drop in output, really large drop in hours worked, a very large rise in unemployment. Thankfully, as bad as those outcomes have been, they've been better than they have been in some other parts of the world. So there is an issue of relativity in terms of what's happening in the economy, as well as central bank action. So all of those things play into our consideration of what we need to do here.
Thank you very much, Guy. I think we do have to draw it to a close now, but thank you for being so generous with your time and answering so many of those questions that came in. There was 60 there, so we didn't get to all of them, but I think we covered a fair chunk of ground. The RBA's actions are always incredibly important, but never more so than during a major economic event like we're currently experiencing, and it's just incredibly valuable to be able to hear from people at the coalface about both what you're doing and the effectiveness of that. So with that, I will wrap up. Thank you, all of you, for tuning in, and I hope to see you in some of the future webinars.